the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM.
Yeah, you could actually do off the couch while listening to Richie's isolation mix. If you've just joined us, you're very welcome. You've missed a good half hour conversation between Joe Malloy and Owen Redden there, talking about his career, how he got good at passing, the pressures of playing with Ron Nogara, and lots more besides. Owen, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, Chair. What's the crack?
You know, the sun is rising gently and looks like it's going to be another beautiful day out there in a world that we're not allowed to go out and sample.
The long old summer that this is going to be is going to feel very strange. Like yesterday, getting out there, it's like, this is June. Yeah. I'm 100% convinced it is June. And it is to do with the weather, but it's also to do with the fact that nobody knows what date it is. So I'm not convinced it is still April, because yesterday sure as hell felt like it's school holidays time or something like that.
Well, it definitely is school holidays. 0904 is what my clock says, which I'm assuming means it's the 9th of April, which means it's Thursday, the 9th of April as well. As I said, it's a public service where we remind everybody what day of week it is. Did have a big long debate with my 8-year-old yesterday about it being Wednesday. She was insisting it was Tuesday, to the point where half an hour later I turned around to my wife and went, is it actually Wednesday? Is it Wednesday? Is it definitely Wednesday? We were like, yeah, because we got a text saying put the bin out. That's how we knew. So, you know, the time is a flat circle thing. That was a bit of a cliche from whatever that was, season one of True Detective. Now I'm like, you know, time might be a flat circle and there might be many alternate realities that we're living in. And this is just the crappy one that we're currently involved in ourselves.
So you had a half an hour debate with your kid about what day it was.
Well, she was insisting it was Tuesday and was like, she's a bit stubborn. I don't know where she got that. Really have no idea, you know.
Could he not have checked your phone? No,
I was refusing. Well, I was busy. I was doing stuff. We were painting. Anyway, always with the facts to bring us down to divert the story from the important parts here. On how was your day yesterday? You've blown the internet up with your insistence that one type of biscuit is 66% superior to another.
Yeah, that's like I see people getting in touch saying that's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not really. I think you can take the opportunity to do a couple of things during the lock-in at the moment. And one of those things that I wanted to achieve was bring the rich tea biscuit down a peg or two, because it doesn't deserve the grace in which it's held by a lot of people. I never understand the hype of it. It's always the most disappointing thing you can find when you open a cupboard. Even as a kid, you'd prefer a piece of fruit to a rich tea biscuit, I would have thought.
I agree. Do you think that the British government's handling of the coronavirus crisis impacted the low score that Rich Tea got?
100%. I think the British government's existence, full stop, it probably impacts the Rich Tea biscuit. Like, it seems that the digestive biscuit probably has more of a Scottish tilt to it when you look into the history of it. But the Rich Tea is very, 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 very English. And I would go as far as to say it is the most Tory biscuit out there.
I have a vague recollection of when I was a child putting butter and jam on digestives and having a butter and jam digestive sandwich.
Yeah, that's certainly been done. I think actually might find more rich tea people would actually put butter and jam on it. But that is exactly what I'm talking about. As a standalone biscuit, it is poor. You actually need to go to the fridge and you need to put a load of cholesterol on that biscuit, which is already not great for you. And that is the only way you can enjoy rich tea. Now, stepping it up to a digestive, that just takes it to a whole new level. It's close to perfect. We all know that the chocolate digestive is the greatest biscuit ever invented, but we won't get to that one for a while. I think Tommy Rooney was saying that he wants his beloved custard creams reviewed soon. I was thinking about putting the custard cream up against the bourbon cream at some stage soon as well. And there's a few other ideas. Like the one thing that perhaps people could be interested in this weekend is Cadbury Easter egg versus Nestle Easter egg. But I'm not sure if I'm ready to cause that level of controversy just yet.
I mean, that's very straightforward. That's a slam dunk win for Cadbury's all day long and twice on Easter Sunday. Let's not talk about this anymore, because we can come back to this a little bit later on. But if anybody wants to get involved in that conversation, feel free to hurl your abuse through WhatsApp to us. 087-9180-180 is the number. If you can't remember that, it's 087-9 as in 9 darts and then 180. So it's 087-9.
I get so much joy out of that every time you say it.
180. I'm aware of what's happening there, by the way. Don't worry. You can also just use the hashtag OTBAM on Twitter. We should talk about a story that's on the back of the mail about how Alexander Seferin, who is the head honcho, is his official term at UEFA, he was never a big fan of the Euros as they were the constellation of games across 10 separate cities that he inherited from Michel Platini. And you'll notice that the next Euros is not going to be that way. So obviously, rather than wait and see how the experiment worked, they were like, no, this is a one-off, very unique situation. Now it turns out we already knew that a bunch of stadiums that were scheduled to play to host games next year already have bookings for the same date next year. So there is already a suggestion that some cities might be unavailable through double bookings. Now some cities, given the effects of what's happening on them, are less than interested in having a bunch of tourists coming through the city in 12 months' time to watch a football match, which, you know, is ultimately very understandable. And the piece in the mail presupposes that we are going to have mass gatherings in precisely the same way that we currently have them. So, you know, fans standing beside each other, sitting beside each other, congregating and drinking and singing. And maybe that's exactly what happens. Maybe, you know, between now and then, there are enough vaccines, everybody gets vaccinated, herd immunity happens, and COVID-19 is a thing that we all look back on and go, Jesus, amazing that we got through that. Maybe that's not what happens at all. The implications of this are that we could have a 5-city or a 4-city or a 1-country Euros next year, with occasional games being played in different places.
That is the implication. Like, I think we have to talk about this story with the assumption that life will be fairly similar to how it was before the outbreak of COVID-19. I think you're right to expect that there may be permanent changes to how we interact with one another, but I think we've got to expect or assume that that's not the case, just for the sake of this story. And this is a big story for Ireland, because you look at some of the venues that perhaps might not be able to host games, perhaps don't want to host games, that have clashes. Bilbao, Rome are two of the venues mentioned in the Mail story this morning. It is mentioned in the Mail online that the UEFA Stadium has may have a clash, but in the back of the Irish Daily Mail this morning, Philip Quinn and his angle on it is that there is no clash for the Aviva Stadium. And just a quick look at the website, there is no clash at the moment. Very early to be planning stuff, but you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So Ireland have a chance now to get a bigger slice of the pie, which is hugely encouraging for an organisation that needs the cash. It's also an organisation, let's not forget, that kind of messed things up when it came to leasing the Aviva Stadium this summer. They weren't actually going to be playing the warm-up games that they qualified at the Aviva Stadium. They would have had to move them somewhere else to a smaller capacity somewhere in Ireland. Whereas now I presume that they can rearrange that next year, perhaps get the Aviva a bit earlier next summer, play a couple of warm-up games in the Aviva, and then potentially have a couple of extra games. Like, I do wonder if there's going to be a land grab from somebody here. Are the FA going to step up and say, well, we can host the entire thing ourselves? Last summer there, in the summer of 2020, we had a lot of quarantined teams playing in the Midlands, carrying out the rest of our Premier League. We could actually run a tournament there, put it in Wembley, and maybe let's hook up with the Scottish Football Association as well, and maybe play a few games in Hampden or whatever. And then I wonder, could there be a further step to this where are Ireland and the UK going to team up for a World Cup bid? I think the answer to that question certainly seems like it is yes over the next few years. Could this potentially be a dry run for them to see how a tournament would run? I know that the other countries like Azerbaijan, for example, will not want to give up their slice of the pie in this whatsoever. But I just wonder if there could be a bit of a political manoeuvring over the next couple of weeks.
Yes, 100% will there be political. Yes. And some countries will seize this as an opportunity and see it as an opportunity to go, look, we're going to help our recovery along by showing everybody that we're open for business in 2021. And so it's an interesting story. And we'll wait and see, and we'll try and do some digging on this side to see exactly where the FAI think that is going to land. And so we have a few calls in with them already this morning to kind of check and see if they've heard or what they're hearing, even if it's been back channels. So we'll bring in news on that on offtheball.com across the rest of the day. The other thing that happened yesterday, obviously, was Colin Buick broke the internet with his Mount Rushmore of Cork sports people. He probably didn't, right? He probably didn't break the internet in so much as there was some minor annoyance in some quarters about the fact that Jimmy Murphy didn't make it. And after that, it was just people putting their own ones up, and which I think is totally fair, right? And that the whole point of this is that it's subjective, I guess.
The Jimmy Barry Murphy thing seems to have stuck in the craw of a lot of people, doesn't it? And I think, in fairness, you did raise the whole appeal of JBM yesterday. And I think there's an element with a few of these Mount Rushmores that people like us on the outside looking in to a county will never be able to tell the true meaning of a player. Of course, you look at Jimmy Barry Murphy from a cold outside perspective. He's great. He's a legend. He would get onto the Mount Rushmore of pretty much any other county. But perhaps we just didn't give him enough respect yesterday, Ger. I know you did, but perhaps I didn't give him enough respect yesterday. Perhaps Cullum didn't give him enough respect yesterday, because people seem to be pretty hurt that JBM is not on it.
Yeah, they were ultimately very angry at that. And that's exactly the whole point about this. You're supposed to... We're talking about an actual mountain where we're going to put people's faces on, and it's unlikely that they're going to come down unless they're, you know, the workmanship is shoddy. So I can see why people would be a little bit pissed off at this. I want to get to some of the comments. It is about iconic figures. This is from Gavin O'Connor. Is it about iconic figures? Because anyone from Cork who didn't go to Prez or Christians would have JBM top of that list. Rogers a legend, but rugby has really only played in two schools in Cork City. Pre-Celtic Tiger, most people didn't know if a rugby ball was pumped or stuffed. And that did, in fact, inspire Colin Bowie to come out and say that he didn't go to Prez or Christians. And obviously, Ronan O'Gara is a complete legend. And O'Gara's stats are off the charts. Like, he's still the highest point scorer in the Heineken Cup in history. You know, he was, I think Colm said that he was the person who was the most synonymous with the success of the tournament in its opening, was it opening two decades? Loads of core comments from YouTube as well. Dave Barry, Jimmy Barry Murphy, Peter Stringer for the try in 06, Roy Sonia, Christy Ring, Rog, Davey Russell didn't even get a mention. That was a complete oversight that he wasn't mentioned. Sonia O'Sullivan, legit world-class in her field, brought our nation to a standstill on numerous occasions. Keane abandoned his country because of ego, says Gary O'Driscoll. So Roy Keane is off several people's Mount Rushmore, even in Cork, which I was a bit surprised about. Terence Buckley says, JBM ahead of O'Gara all day long. I've been getting this a lot, Terence, but I can't ignore what Rog achieved for Munster in Ireland. So Colin Buig was actually in the YouTube comments last night fighting back and defending his guy, which was fair enough. And then we don't need to do Donegal, apparently, because it's already been done. Do we have the picture of the Mount Rushmore? Is 1, 2, 3, 4 separate faces, as it should be, of Michael Murphy, the LeBron James at the GAA, as I've said in the past, and that is an accurate reflection of what Mount Rushmore and Donegal should look like. I mean, the entire McHugh family are feeling a little bit, hang on a second, what?
And like Andrew McGuinness, can I just go back to what, like, I know we've gone into this a lot yesterday, but what Gavin O'Connor was saying yesterday was really interesting debate between you guys on Twitter yesterday. But just on the point of there being two rugby schools, say, in Cork, does that not heighten the achievement of what Ronan O'Gara did even more? That if you say that rugby exists on the periphery of Cork society, then for him to become so synonymous with Cork and for him to be one of the beacons of life from Cork sport in a very crowded field, I think that just makes it all the more special. Like, I was definitely on the fence. I was on the fence about everybody outside of Roy Keane and Sonny O'Sullivan, let's face it, yesterday. But I think the way Colm actually argued it yesterday, in his defence, I think he's made a very compelling case for Rog, to the point where he would definitely be number three on the mountain for me, and somebody you wouldn't be chiselling away were somebody to make a strong JBM case, for example. It would be Christy Ring you'd almost replace with JBM.
Yeah, and that was the thing for me. Like, I actually do feel that, like, in some instances, having a representation from different sports is valuable, because you have to reflect the entire life of a county. And having GA is so important. Cork, obviously, for so long, top of the Roll of Honour in hurling. You could make the case for that being the single most important sport in the county. But what O'Gara did, like, was be a part of the team that changed Irish rugby forever. The expectations when he came in were that they would win two games, three games, one game, two games, three games in the Six Nations or the Five Nations. And that expectation went, no, we're going to win the tournament every year. And if we don't win it, it's a cause for months and months of hand-wringing and controversy. And so, like, him and O'Driscoll, and later O'Connell, but him and O'Driscoll at the start, were the ones who gave us that sense that this is something and that was possible. And okay, so rugby isn't a truly global sport, but it is a more international sport than GAA, for example. It is played by more people, and he was an important figure in the global game for a very long time. There was one other thing, a recommendation for the classic game club, Liverpool versus Palace FA Cup 1990 from Connor Minchin. I think that's a 3-all draw. Is that right?
Yeah, that'll be a Nathan Murphy special.
Ian Wright and Mark Bright line up front for Palace. Nearly certain. And most importantly, Chris McNulty, I paused my TV to watch Owen Sheehan eat biscuits, so you should too. This is obviously people sitting on their couch when you dropped the first edition of Bar Wars last night at whatever time was it, like 9:15, 9:25. Obviously, you've done your research, Owen. This is when people feel like, I'm going to get something to eat. What am I going to? I'm going to not eating any rich teas after eating that. Two rich teas.
Or he picked a time when everybody actually first is watching TV. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, good idea. David Carr says, you could eat two rich teas for every digestive if you were watching much eat. Major overlook on Owen's part.
David, nobody is watching what they eat at the moment, I think is the response to that. But in the future, if life gets back to some sort of normality, absolutely. I think Chris McNulty's tweet as well, he said, I paused my TV for 4.5 minutes, at which point I realised that I'd banged on about this thing for clearly 3 minutes way too long. I didn't realise it was actually that duration. I was sitting there wondering, why is this taking this so long to upload? And then afterwards I was like, because this is way too long and way too much time to spend on a subject. Also on the Palace-Liverpool game, it was 4-3, the 1990 FA Cup semi-final.
4-3, okay. To Palace.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, sorry, a mistake on my part. So the Sports Bulletin, it is, 70 minutes past 8 here this morning on Thursday, the 9th of April. I'm going to keep repeating that, so I actually believe it. Man City are believed to be in advanced talks with their players over a pay cut. Last season's Premier League champions did not furlough their staff. City could suffer a £100 million hit if the current season is not completed. Obviously, Manchester City have all the wealth in the world, though. So, you know, no one's kind of saying well done to any of the teams who are doing what they should be doing. Not all cities may host Euro 2021 games that have been slated to do so. The Irish Daily Mail are reporting Bilbao and Rome in particular may not stage matches. Dublin is due to host 4 games and could be in line to accommodate more. Premier League players have created a fund to directly help the National Health Service in the UK. Players Together is the name of it, and they say they'll be distributing money to where it's needed most. The initiative has been spearheaded by Liverpool captain Jordan Henderson, but has been joined by many Premier League footballers. The fund will help enhance the well-being of NHS staff, volunteers and patients impacted by the coronavirus. Players Together has been welcomed by UK politicians who had previously been critical, of course, of the response from football. Real Madrid players, management and officials have agreed to take between a 10-20% pay cut. The size of the cuts are dependent on how the Spanish season ends. Football in Spain obviously is suspended, with hopes that the Liga season can resume in June, which seems very soon given the death toll at the moment in Spain. Gaelic Games Semple Stadium is getting a facelift. Tipperary County Council have greenlit plans to renovate the Thurles Grounds old Canaan stand. And the redevelopment will include new dressing rooms, media facilities and a gym. Here's what's coming up on the show this morning. You've already missed Owen Redden. We've talked about some of the main stories today. The sports page is coming your way now. Andy Mitten's going to join us at 8:30. We have a lockdown lowdown coming your way at 8:50. Ray Moylett's going to join us at 9 o'clock. A crappy quiz, a slightly boozy crappy quiz at 9:20. And the player ratings from season 3 of Better Call Saul are coming your way at 9:45. We're going to start now with the sports pages. OTB AM. So first up, we have offtheball.com for you this morning. And the homepage there, Jordan Henderson leads hashtag players together in helping the NHS. And a couple of other stories there. I'm jumping around like a lunatic in this studio. Pat Nevin on missing the 2012 Champions League. So that's doing a feature in the evening, a classic Champions League and great stories and matches in history. And Pat Nevin was this week's guest talking about Chelsea. UFC, well, the UFC had a crazy plan where they're going to try and proceed having some fights on Native American tribal land. We'll wait and see exactly what happens with that. In rugby, great story here with an amazing picture. We weren't rugby players, we were weightlifters. This is from Brian O'Driscoll and Ronald O'Gara's piece the other night. And the picture that we have illustrating that is Brian O'Driscoll doing weights. I was like, oh, I'm asking you who you think he looks like in this photograph. And what was your answer?
Well, I kind of came up with no one. Tommy was suggesting Sean O'Brien.
I thought he looked like Richie McCaw in the picture. But it's interesting, we both went from back row forward. So this is obviously the point he was talking about, that I think this is the build-up to 2007, where they just let the strength and conditioning get out of hand and came back big and slow, as opposed to actually coming back ready to take on the world. And that was one of those great opportunities missed. But yeah, so that's what's on offtheball.com. Loads and loads and loads of stories. And loads of people are tuning into offtheball.com every day now for the very latest on their sports news and what's happening. So keep doing that. Obviously, sorry, the review of Kieran Bradley's reviews of Sunderland Till I Die, it includes the phrase "the smell I want." And I'm on board with anything that includes the phrase "the smell I want."
Absolutely. They're great pieces. They're worth checking out. I'm going to move on to the Irish Independent this morning. They lead with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's interview with Gary Neville. Solskjaer saying United can exploit transfer market during crisis. This caused a little bit of controversy. Gary Neville has come out to say that he perhaps shouldn't have used the word exploit in his question to Solskjaer, which was basically around the idea that a club like Manchester United with huge reserves of cash could potentially exploit the situation of the transfer market afterwards, because the rich will probably be hit a little bit less than the poor clubs, and I should say the poorer clubs, and how they will react to these comments from Solskjaer remains to be seen. You've also got El Buzetti here, Zach El Buzetti, who's been in conversation with Dan McDonnell about Stephen Kenny and how he's going to let stars shine. He's, of course, been somebody who's played under him at under-21s, so giving a bit of insight. And then the main photograph on the back of the Irish Independent this morning is Tiger Woods wearing his green jacket, having some dinner today. It kind of makes you feel a little bit sad. Today was the day that the Masters was supposed to be off.
The Irish Times Sports Thursday: Pro 14 sides face €15 million loss of TV money if league not completed. Bernard Laporte has been saying as well that it's possible there won't be any club rugby in 2020. There'll be internationals at the end of the year, and club rugby will come back in January 2021, which is as credible an outcome that I've heard suggested as any of the other outcomes that have been suggested so far at this stage, given that we're in a complete phase of uncertainty, and the unknown unknowns that are still to present themselves must be the overriding kind of sense of what's actually going to happen here. Johnson's trip to Twickenham cited as reason for go ahead. This is a Guardian story about why Cheltenham went ahead. Get into that a little bit later on. Mourinho admits public park training session was wrong during crisis. Oh shit, Sherlock. And Dave Hannigan had a column, which I haven't had a chance to read yet. Hurling advocate Dowling at the sharp end of COVID-19 fight. Decades in America have not loosened the bonds with home or diminished his capacity for testifying about how hurling shaped him and his outlook. I look down on other sports, he said. So even in the midst of the pandemic, hurling snobs are still being heard and having columns written about them. And, you know, never change, hurling snobs, never change.
Speaking of hurling and people who like to bask in the greatness of the game, Kieran Shannon's column today is "The Hurlers Who Talk the Talk as Well as They Walk the Walk." So he's saying here that everybody seems to be doing every county's Mount Rushmore at the moment, and everybody seems to be picking their favourite games, that he's gone for something a little bit different at the moment. In his column, he's gone for his best interviewee hurling 15. So not just the great players.
Great idea.
Yeah, it is. It's a great idea. The team is Joe Quaid in goal, Anne Downey, Anthony Daly and Kyle Freeman, the full back line, Tony Brown, Brian Corcoran, Larry O'Gorman, the half back line, Dennis Coughlin and Kieran Carey in midfield, a half forward line, which is a half forward line here is pretty class, Eddie Brennan, Henry Shefflin and Tony Griffin, and then a full forward line of Shane Fitzgibbon, Tommy Guilfoyle and Connor Cusack. So it turns out being an interesting interviewee does not necessarily mean you're an average hurler or an average camogie player or manager or whatsoever, because that's a quality team.
Yeah, exactly. That was the thing. It's like, these are all pretty good, you know, many all-stars, many, many All-Ireland medals between them. So maybe that helps as well. Right. So the Irish Daily Mail, Euros revamp, Dublin could get extra games if other nations drop out. Matt Hughes has this story in the English Mail. Philip Quinn has obviously added some Irish details on it as well. They're saying Sportsmail has learned the Spanish and Italian FAs have both expressed doubts about honouring commitments to host games in Bilbao and Rome, given the large death tolls and economic suffering they have experienced over the last few months. From an Irish perspective, the FAI remain committed to hosting games at the Aviva next year, and there are no other major events scheduled to be held in the stadium next summer. Dublin venue is obviously scheduled to host three games and one match from the round of 16 from the group, so four in total. If other nations opt out, there is the possibility of the Aviva being asked to stage additional fixtures. And again, I suppose this, look, will the Euros go ahead? Will people be allowed to travel from country to country? I mean, at the moment, you can. So you would assume that if we haven't locked our ports now, we might never lock our ports. So maybe in a year's time, a vaccine has dropped and everybody's, if you've got papers, you've been vaccinated, you're allowed to come in and away we go. And everybody, we corral all the tourists down to Temple Bar, and this helps kickstart some sense of, I don't know, all of us coming out of this.
Yeah, possibly. Like, it is still summer 2021. I think the idea of what you mentioned there a moment ago of rugby perhaps facing up to the fact that it'll probably be the start of 2021 before they actually get club rugby underway. I think that even at that point, you're skeptical about whether or not there will actually be supporters at those games and how long behind closed doors support will go on for after it comes back. And I think with football, that's just amplified because you've got all this fanfare around the game. You've got international movement, particularly with a tournament like this. And like, it just seems like the furthest thing away from our current situation. And to say that it might be over a year for it to return, I think is, it almost feels like a fact at this point. It almost feels like it's an inevitability that it will take more than a year for us to return to that. I'm going to move on to the Irish Sun this morning. They're leading with Sadio Mane's comments. People matter, not the title. Sad situation, but public comes first. Mane here coming to terms with the prospect of Liverpool not being crowned champions, but says there are more important things in the world at the moment. Green tea at Tigers is the headline, with his photograph of him having dinner in his green jacket. Jose, park strife, Spurs boss is slammed. Jose Mourinho, of course, apologised for going to Hadley Common and working out with Tanguy and Ndombele yesterday. It has been confirmed that Ndombele walked home with two other players. He was Sessegnon and I can't remember who the other player was. God, it just slipped my mind. Davinson Sanchez. And they did, according to an eyewitness, keep 20 meters apart. So the three of them met up, but kept good social distancing. So it's not been all bad for Spurs. They haven't completely disregarded it. But Jose was saying stuff yesterday like it's essential that we all do our part. It's clearly not essential in somebody's eyes or some people's eyes.
They, in my head, they all live in one of those shared living spaces that we were going to be building loads of until this all happens, you know, with the same kitchen and common area. And then like room for a single bed and maybe a jacks in your room. That's where those three footballers live, right?
I think Ryan Sessegnon, when he goes home, actually has to pull his bed out from a cupboard to actually go to sleep.
Tower of the morning to you comes from the Mirror. I should have been the spatial one. Spurs fury at close quarters training. Jose's apology to NHS heroes for risky public park session. I should have been the spatial one. And then that's class. I won't hear any bad words said about that headline writer. And then the headline above that is Ole warning, we'll spend. And there's a picture of Jack Grealish. Look, you're not supposed to say these things. And he was asked a question and at the same time, I don't know, is there going to be a pylon here because he's talking about the transfer market while 900 odd people died in England yesterday? Like, this is on a daily basis, the rolling death total in England is absolutely shocking. And, you know, it feels like it could have been avoided if they'd gone into lockdown a little bit earlier. Certainly they would have slowed it down. But is it unseemly to be talking about this, or is it actually the right thing to be doing, to be going ahead with business as normal?
Like, he's talking about when business resumes and what happens when business resumes. Like, as you say, he's asked the question. Gary Neville has said that he shouldn't have used the word exploit. People can use a word not intends to use the word in the sense that it's always intended. It's not a great word to use in that sense. But I think to enrage like the public to the point of a pylon at this point, I think would just be a little bit OTT. Like, what are you supposed to do when a question like that is asked? What are you supposed to do when you say the wrong word? Like, you say, right, I could have used a different word. But I think it's a bit of a, it's not a huge story whatsoever. And like you say, is there going to be a pylon? I don't think there has been a pylon so far. And I'd have a little bit of sympathy certainly for Solskjaer in this situation if it becomes a story. I've got the Irish Daily Star here. Jose Mourinho there again saying, I was wrong, regret, a public meetup. Vinnie Perth on managing in lockdown, he's been spoken to in the Irish Daily Star. There's a Conor Myler exclusive. The Tyrone footballer has said, we can't hug my mother. She's a frontline worker and has to stay in a room by herself. Mane says, I will wait for title glory. And Manchester United aim at transfers.
London Times have a picture of Ronaldinho under house arrest over a fake passport. This has been like any other time we would have been like going a deep dive on this story and just how amazing and ridiculous the whole thing is. But he's in Paraguay. He had a fake passport. He was released on bail. That was the last I read, but it was like bail of 1.3 million or something absolutely ludicrous. So he's in a bit of trouble. He's in a spot of bother. And there's pictures of guards with a mask on, but you can see that that is Ronaldinho, the footballer. Mourinho told off by Mayor Farah's data to be examined while all this is going on as well. The circle around Mo Farah is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The new chief executive of UK Athletics has said that she will hand over a 2015 report to anti-doping officials that includes Mo Farah's medical data. And City closing on pay cuts is the story we've already spoken about. Manchester City are in advanced talks with their players about wage deferrals, the Times can reveal. So City coming out now and saying they're ready to go with that.
It's that story about Mo Farah and UK Athletics as well on the back of The Guardian this morning. Colts wants ethical success. UK Athletics head pledges to hand over a Salazar Farah report. Got a picture there of Ben Stokes as well, an Englishman who joined the national conversation. He's been named the world's best cricketer. And Mourinho admits training for Ndombele was a mistake. A couple of other stories then there as well. Alderweireld's agent defends players against salary cuts. The one thing that we can say, like, it's just in relation to this Solskjaer story, is that I think we would all have genuine sympathy for kind of a word being misplaced here or there, and I think a pylon would be wrong. If it were an agent and there was a pylon and an agent was talking about exploiting the transfer market, that is when things would be properly sickening, and that is when a pylon would probably be borderline acceptable. Not that pylons are ever acceptable.
Well, that's the thing. I think that we're just a little bit anxious to avoid pylons at the moment. There seems to be a lot of encouragement for pylons at every available opportunity, and not really going to help the mental health of the nation. In the Telegraph this morning, SPFL proposes the termination of campaigns in lower leagues, which would be, you know, a full stop on all of those seasons, which might not be the worst thing that's ever happened. Pay deadlock leaves clubs heading for cliff edge. This is the talks between the PFA and the Premier League and the FA are not going very well. And experts want spitting on ball banned over infection risk. So this is how sport is going to end up dealing. This is a cricket story, but obviously it kind of goes, you know, spitting on the pitch. One of those things that you're like, do we need to do that? You know, the way that players and cyclists clean out their nose and it goes everywhere. You see joggers still doing it. You're like, oh, come on.
Like what? That was never, should we ban that was never spitting? A thing to do.
What?
Like, I don't know. Okay, like to people who exercise and stuff like that, like what difference is it going to make, I guess, if you're actually playing contact sports with somebody, but people who spit unnecessarily, that should never have been a thing, is my point. If it's if it's necessary in a sports pitch, whatever, I fear that is possibly a wormhole that we could delve into. I need to get through the Herald very quickly. Zach is back in Kenny. El Buzedi here again. This is the Dan McDonald story. Players will relish freedom. And Larry never imagined life without playing golf.
Well, okay, we'll get to that. I really look forward to your deep dive on the merits of spitting on a football pitch or while jogging on. This could be the hottest of hot takes that you've ever had. 0879 180 180 is the number. If you want to get in touch with us by WhatsApp, you can use the hashtag OTBAM. Now, it is, 8:34 this morning here. Tonight on Off the Ball, absolutely thrilled to say that we're going to be joined by Shane Lowry. He's caught up with Nathan Murphy yesterday afternoon with thanks to Bank of Ireland. Here's Shane talking about how he's been dealing with everything in recent weeks.
Yeah, what can you do? Because if you are looking for the positives and like this is a break, an unexpected break, maybe a time to collect some thoughts and particularly with the year you've had, reflect. Maybe you'd already thought you'd had that period of this year and you were going to be into the real hard slog over the next few months. Have you been in touch a lot with Neil Manship about how you come out of this in a good place?
Yeah, I speak to Neil every few days, but I, as regards myself, like I think I was most disappointed at the start of the whole thing, you know, after the players, because I really felt like I was starting to play some decent golf, and I felt like I was coming into some tournaments that suited my game. Obviously, the Masters, that's supposed to be this week, where I was looking forward to that, and you know, I had a very exciting summer ahead of me. I was going to get to play the Irish Open in Mount Juliet, you know, as the Open champion. I was going to get to go and defend the Open. So that's where I kind of struggled, but it was all selfish things. It was all like, you know, I don't get to do this. So it's very disappointing for me. But, you know, like I've never had a break like this. I've never had a period of time where I'm not looking towards the next tournament, as in, like, I don't know when we're going to be back playing, so I don't have a date. So it's difficult to kind of set goals, but I try and set some, like, weekly goals and daily goals and, you know, hit them. And, look, I talk about the gym and doing some exercise and I have that, but I'm not the person that, you know, I'm not looking to, like, lose loads of weight coming out of this. I'm not looking to change my body shape or, you know, anything like that. I'm just looking to I am looking to get a little bit fitter, a little bit stronger through the whole thing. And, you know, we'll see what happens then when it all finishes.
These Peloton bikes seem to be the new phenomenon. I see Rory McIlroy is a world leading his competitive edge. He seems to be up against Justin Thomas. I don't know a huge amount about it, but are you getting involved in this?
I have a Peloton bike, but I won't give anyone my username. So I got one, I ordered one online and it came there a few weeks ago. It's great. It's like an online spin bike. And,
right.
You know, I get on it for like 45 minutes most days and do as much as I can and do as hard as I can. But I'm like I see Rory and a friend of mine here, Stephen Grant, is living over here as well. And he's got one and he's a bit of a beast on it. Like, he's finishing the top 50 out of 50,000 people. Whereas I'm happy if, like, I'm kind of looking to, if I finish in the top 10 or 15% of the people doing it, I'm pretty happy. So, yeah, look, it's something to keep me occupied and something to do every day. And, it passes an extra hour in the day, I suppose. Mm.
They should get the lads to do a Peloton ad instead of the one that went viral on the internet. And also, it sounds like Shane Lowry Stephen Grant and Rory McIlroy are the equivalent of you, Owen, at the London 2020 Olympics game, except they're doing it on the bike and it's good for them. A full interview with Shane Lowry will be available on all the OTB channels, so YouTube, Facebook, Twitter and offtheball.com this afternoon. It is all in association with Bank of Ireland, who are here to support their customers through the impact of coronavirus. Check out bankofireland.com. And if you want to get in touch with us now, the best way to do so, you can get us on WhatsApp. 087-9180-180 is the number. Or, of course, you can always get us using the hashtag OTBAM. Now, it is, 8:38 this morning. Let's say hello to Andy Mitten for the first time in a little while. Andy, how are you getting on?
I'm okay, nice to talk to you. I think it's a month since I was in Austria when Manchester United played their last game a month ago today, that game behind closed doors in Lask. I've been in lockdown. I'm in with my family in Barcelona and I can't leave the house, basically. But all things considered, everything's all right. I can go to...
You can go to the shop.
Yeah, but you need to take ID. You need to keep the receipts when you've been in the shop. And I'd love to go for a run. I'd love to go out on my bike. I'd love to go out with my children. But all things considered, we're fine. It's changing the shape of journalism. There's people are still reading an awful lot. Other people are just running out of money to pay for content. I'm writing lots of historical pieces, catching up with administration and stuff. And I probably travelled far too much in the 6 weeks before the lockdown. I went on 8 different trips in 4 weeks. So it's not been that bad seeing my family. I'm sure everyone's got issues and probably a lot of them have got far more issues than I've had.
What has it actually been like in Spain and what are the conversations that you've been having with neighbours and people across the country, because Spain was obviously really badly hit very early on and it doesn't look like it's peaked yet. It looks like the difficulties that they're having are continuing.
Yeah, it's very pronounced here. The rates are the highest in Europe along with Italy, and at one point last week, Catalonia and New York had the steepest rises of anywhere in the world. So Madrid has been the hot spot. And I started looking more into the figures in more in a detailed way last week. And you start to learn that people in the poorer areas are suffering a lot more because they live in the most dense housing. Maybe lots of Spaniards don't have gardens. They live in small apartments. And it's bad in Catalonia as well. And some very well-known people have died. The former president of Real Madrid, Josep Guardiola's mother and the Guardiola family were very, very well respected. I remember going to their small town a couple of years ago to do a piece on him. And really, it's not an attractive town, San Depor, where Guardiola's from. And the people were lovely. And they said, oh, do you want to go meet his mum and dad? And it was a Sunday afternoon. And I thought, I'm not just going to knock on the door. So I didn't. Maybe I'm a bad journalist for that, but there's real worry in Spain, and the lockdown, it is a very strong one. People could argue that, you know, if I take my children out for a walk and I'm with them, the chances of them catching the virus are extremely minimal, but we're just following the advice. And like everybody, I hope for a return to normality. I was going to Barcelona, Napoli, and then that was put behind closed doors, and then it was cancelled. The Valencia-Atlanta game, I think history will judge that as being a big carrier of the virus, because lots of Valencian fans, players, journalists came back from Bergamo, Milan, and they introduced the virus into Valencia. So there's all these crossovers with sport and with football. The media is actually doing quite well. People are still buying newspapers. Spaniards listen to a lot of radio. They watch a lot of TV. Barca's political problems are rumbling on. I've suspected for a long, long time, and more than suspected, you know, I've had it well sourced from good people, that Barca are really struggling financially. And this is coming to the fore now. They've got a huge wage bill. They've bought really badly. They bought three players above 100 million who haven't really worked out for them. And they've got to sell. And I know people at quite a high level within the club who for a long time have painted a picture of, we're basically trimming everything back just so we can pay Lionel Messi. And that never seemed like a stable business model to me, although he's clearly the best player in the world and he's brilliant. Man United, there's still interest there. Some footballers I find are keen to talk, others are not keen to talk. I spoke to footballers in Italy. I spoke the other day to Federico Maqueda. He's in Athens. It was the anniversary of his goal against Aston Villa, and he was fine talking. But I've spoken to a couple of other lads who play in Italy, a couple of lads who were on loan from Man United, and they just want a low profile at the moment. And I suppose you've got to respect that. There's much more important and worse things happening than the resumption of a football season. So I'm still writing. We're producing a United We Stand. We're taking a huge gamble with that. And I'm alarmed at the postage rates to Ireland. It's nearly £3 for us to send one there. We've got a lot of readers in Ireland. But we're printing it. The Royal Mail's working. The lads who'd normally sell United We Stand outside Old Trafford, they're going to get their commissions by sending it out. And we just need people to buy it. And if they don't, then we can't carry on during the lockdown. But people are reading a lot more. They're telling us that's what they want. And I'm sure they're watching this. And there's still a big thirst for information, mainly about the virus, but maybe sport, not for the first time, is a release.
For sure, and I think that it will be an even bigger release when it comes back, even if that is just behind closed doors. We might get into that in a moment, Andy, but I just have one question on Barcelona, and you mentioned there the extortionate wage bill that the club now has and the financial trouble that it seems is coming down the line or is perhaps already here. What is going on politically at the moment? Because it seemed to me last week or the week before we were reading a story about Barcelona players not being willing to take a wage cut. And then this week we see Lionel Messi coming out saying that was nonsense. I'm willing to give up my wages to ensure all our staff can be fully employed and fully paid.
They're both right. Basically, the players have held the club to hostage for years. They've realised that if they went public when at the point of negotiating a new contract, they tend to get a new contract. You know, for decades, I looked at Barca as this perfectly run football club where, maybe perfect's the wrong word, but fans had power, you voted in the president, and the closer I get to it, it's like the closer you get into the sun. There's so many shifting plates of power that politically it's quite unstable. And this model where the president, and the only people who get voted in as presidents, they're not real fans. It's rich people who've got the contacts to run a campaign. And I just see it's an extremely political club with factions all the time. And I lean away from it the more I learn of it. And I don't think it lends itself to long-term projects. The redevelopment of Camp Nou still hasn't started, because whichever president does it on his watch and spends $300, $400, $500, $600 million, they're going to have to pare back spending on the first team, which means there's going to be probably a lack of success. And no president wants that on his watch. And what I've also seen in the last few years is the rise of the fans of the super club. Incredibly impatient online fans scattered around the world whose viewpoints are completely different from people who actually go to the games. And you see these Barca fans online, and if they're not top and winning every game 5-0 and winning the Champions League, they're absolutely furious. And it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. And I think that held sway in sacking Ernesto Valverde. Well, his team were top of the league, having won the league last year and the year before. It is just ridiculous. The bar has been raised so high that I don't think any football club in the world can reach these levels. There's tension between the players in an aging team. All them players that Messi, that Piqué, Busquets, Alba, they're all well over 30 now. They have a huge amount of power. I don't think that the current manager can even start to play the type of football that he wants to play, because the players will just turn around and say, this is not how we do it here. So it's a problem. They've been at the top of the table, and they're still a very good team. But I do wonder when Messi moves on, and I've done a big piece looking into the Masia and the youth system. That's not what it was either. Still a huge club, still extremely attractive. Barcelona's a great place to live. But I don't think it's a financially stable model. And the virus has just exacerbated the issues at Barcelona, which are coming to the fore now.
Literally just about to make that point that things weren't amazing before COVID-19, and this is going to make things a hell of a lot worse. You mentioned the financial impact that it is going to have and how that will exacerbate things. But also politically, everybody's going to be a little bit more wound up. These stories and conflicting reports don't help things. We saw Lionel Messi call Eric Abidal out earlier on in the year, which obviously raised a few question marks about how long more Lionel Messi is going to hang around if he feels that he's not getting the respect from the hierarchy. What's your view on that?
I'm really torn on it, because part of me thinks it's greed, doesn't need it. And part of me thinks he is the best player in the world. He should be paid the most money in the world. But at what point, I remember interviewing him years ago, and he said to me when the interview was finished, what's happening at Manchester City? And I said, well, why don't you just ask Carlos Tevez? And the fact that he hadn't done, why is he asking a journalist? And it was off the record. And he was very interested in the money which Manchester City were paying. So he likes money. Obviously, he's entitled to that because he's a great player. And I think he's a decent person. He's not the intellectual that Eric Abidal is, who is not Lilian Thuram either, who's extremely bright. But I've interviewed Abidal a few times. He's a bright, bright guy. And it's funny how football moves quickly, because I remember at the start of January, and one of Abidal's former teammates, who was at Man United, said, Eric's in Dubai, he's never leaving there, he's so happy there. And then a few months later, he rocks up as Barcelona's sporting director. Patrick Kluivert's in there now. What are they overseeing? An aging team? A club where the youth system is not producing the talent that it did do? One where Lionel Messi, what is he, 33, 32, 33? He might be able to play because he's Messi. He might be able to do a gigs, but that explosive pace is a really important part of his game, although he's got so many other qualities to his game. But I'm uncomfortable with it. In answer to your question, I'm uncomfortable with the way that I think they use English clubs, like Sergio Ramos did with Madrid, as a potential suitor. And then they go back to their own club and say, well, I could get this in Manchester. Now, it's brinkmanship. They are entitled to do that. It's a dog-eat-dog world, but they do that. And it just makes me think all this more than a club stuff. It's a little bit hollow. You know, when they're charging visiting fans more than any other club in the history of football for away tickets, I just think, more than a club are you? Yet you're charging €129 for Man United or for Tottenham or for Manchester City fans to visit your stadium. stuff like that tarnishes their image.
That's very interesting what you mentioned there about Lionel Messi and his interest in money and his interest in Manchester City, because what they can bring financially, like if he's that interested in money and they can pay him what he wants, and he's also got a great suitor in Pep Guardiola, it does seem that this talk about Messi and his connection potentially with Manchester City isn't just idle talk anymore. There is actual substance to it, and there may be real consideration on Messi's part.
This was a long time ago when he asked me that question direct. Okay. In fact, Carlos Tevez was at the club, and that was my first response. Why don't you ask Tevez? I think he always knows there's a suitor there. I also think that he's very happy living where he is. His children are very settled. They're taught in English, bizarrely. And I think his wife settled. They live in a beautiful part of the world. They overlook the sea. His neighbours are his close friends. Luis Suarez, Sergio Busquets. He's a hero. And you can argue to this day that Barca, along with Madrid and Barcelona, are the biggest club in the world. And Barca fans will argue that they are the biggest club in the world. They're playing in the biggest stadium, playing to huge crowds. Still an exceptionally good team. Nobody will be absolutely stunned if they won the Champions League, but they're not the Barca of old. They're definitely not the Barca of old. But then I also think it's unfair to compare the current team or any team to Guardiola's great sides, because I've never seen any team as good as Guardiola's Barca side. When they blew away Real Madrid 5-0, when they beat Manchester United and ruined a few days for me in Rome and then at Wembley, they were absolutely outstanding. They were incredible. And I remember being at Wembley in May 11 and they just won the European Cup. And I'm reporting on it as a journalist, but obviously I'm from Manchester and I'm a United fan. And I bumped into Andy Cole and he just said, tampered with. They tampered with us. They tampered with us. I'll never forget that. And they were outstanding and they've still got great players, but they bought badly. They've wasted a lot of money. They've got this lopsided business model. Yes, they're doing well in terms of getting sponsorships by following the Man United model of getting sponsors from around the world. But I'm not convinced, and I'm sure you can tell by my tone. Mm-hmm. I still would think that Messi would stay. Well, I mean, what's he going to do with the money? He's made for life over and over and over and over again. But it's going to the club and saying, I could get this elsewhere. I'm just not comfortable with it. And also, Manchester City have got to stay within the financial fair play rules, because they've been in a little bit of trouble in that area as well in the past. Yeah. But, you know, Guardiola, I think, is going to stay at City. I think his family are back in Spain. And he obviously loves Pep and he loves Messi. The feeling's mutual. But I would still think, unless there's a mighty fallout, which there could be, he'll stay in Barcelona.
Just a last question then, Andy. You've touched on the importance of having conversations like these and the importance of thinking about football right now. That will translate into wanting football back sooner rather than later. And if it's done in a safe way, I don't think anybody can really disagree with that. If it's not too much of a burden on the health service of various countries and if all the players are kept in safe quarantine or whatever it may be. How is it looking in La Liga at the moment? I know Javier Tebas came out the last couple of days and said it could be May, it could be June, it could be July, but we could look at a run of games behind closed doors. Premier League Chiefs obviously looking into something similar, and Bundesliga teams training with social distancing during the week. It does seem that this will come together in a situation where we might have something to look forward to, even just on television alone.
Yeah, Tebas was the first person to actually put dates to it, and he gave three options, and I think the first one's optimistic, but I'm not a medical specialist, I just don't know. And like everyone, I'd love to see football back. Behind closed doors, I'm really torn on that. I was in Linz, Austria for that game, and it was awful. It was awful. But I accept, played on television, it would be entertaining. People would love to see it. Most football fans do not have the luxury of going to the stadiums, and they would watch, you know, Liverpool against whoever or Manchester United against whoever on TV and take a lot from that. But I think that football without the fans at the games is nothing. I think atmosphere is integral to it. And I was really uncomfortable watching that Man United game in Austria. It was horrible. I felt more sympathy for the host team than for United. They lost out on their big day, their payday. It was awful. It was absolutely horrible. And I don't like behind closed doors football. Now, is it better than nothing? Yeah, it probably is better than nothing. needs must. Yeah, probably, but I'm not entirely comfortable about it. But I can also see that if tens of thousands of people are gathering at one stadium, then there's a potential for the virus to resurface. Mm. Maybe just limit it to teams who don't sell the ground out, where there's plenty of space and you can social distance. I could make some easy digs at clubs here, but I'm not going to.
I think you did. Andy, great to have you with us. Great to talk to you again, and stay well. Thanks a million, man.
Thank you.
It's Andy Mitten there, editor of United We Stand, and we look forward to getting our hands on the next copy of that whenever it is released. And best of luck to everybody putting out content at this point. A quick reminder, as part of our Champions League Best Moments series in association with Virgin Media Sport, we caught up with Pat Nevin on the show last night to talk about his favourite Champions League moments. Here he is talking about Fernando Torres' spine-tingling goal against Barcelona.
I did a thing afterwards. I was writing for the Chelsea website, and I write every week for them. I have done for forever.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I'm not even going to write anything. Just tell me what you did when that goal went in, because what I did was really weird, right? I've never jumped about like a loony like that in my life, especially in a studio when you're going live on air in 3 seconds. And the stories I got in were incredible, from three broken legs, three people broke their legs as they jumped up and fell through tables or that. Mm. One guy told me he was in a dog hole, you know, so he was actually in a battle. He was a medic, but there was shots being fired above him. And he was listening to it on the radio. And honestly, the stories were absolutely extraordinary about it. And, you know, it's an amazing thing that Chelsea, at the time they absolutely did not think they were going to do it, was the day they done it.
Yeah, it was such a postscript to the really peak years. And then boom, you know, for Lampard and for Terry, it was this amazing finale, I'm sure, for them. We have about two and a half minutes, so it is time for you to unveil. You've given this some thought. You've looked through the Chelsea of the 21st century primarily here. What is your Champions League moment? What are you going with?
Well, the Champions League moment is very special. It was the semi-final that year. It wasn't the final. It was the semi-final against Barcelona. So Chelsea are playing against them. They've not got much of a chance. They're away at Barcelona. They have to get a result. They have to get at least a draw over there. They have no chance. What does John Terry do? He gets sent off after 37 minutes. Your team, talking about team with Xavi, Iniesta, Messi, you know, they are just Busquets, the whole bunch. And Chelsea, after 12 minutes, also lost their other centre-half, Gary Cahill. So they haven't got a defence. They've no chance, right? And they're just the weirdest things happen. Barca keep on trying to cross the balls in high. They've got Sanchez in the middle. Mm. They've got Messi in the middle. There's no chance. They're never going to do it. They keep on doing this. Chelsea have a breakaway goal. Ramirez scores the most incredible dink goal.
Oh, yeah, the dink. Yeah, out of nowhere.
Right, out of nowhere. And you just think, you've not got that in your locker, mate. Where the hell's that come from?
Fernando Torres, the goal that put Chelsea through to the Champions League final there, as described by Pat Nevin from our Champions League Best Moments series in association with Virgin Media Sport. Use the hashtag WeFreeSport. Now, it's coming up to 9 o'clock, 8:58 this morning, this Thursday morning. It's Thursday, the 9th of April. That's our public service done for this hour. Thanks very much for joining us here on OTBM. Plenty more to come in the next hour. We've got the crappy quiz. Irish boxer Ray Moylett is our off-the-couch expert today, helping us to stay fit and get healthy. A report on Michael Darren McCauley's work in the North Inner City of Dublin, and of course our player ratings for season 3 of Better Call Saul. If you haven't subscribed yet, there's plenty for you on the Off the Ball YouTube channel and also on the OTB Podcast Network. Just hit subscribe wherever you get your stuff. Best place for us is the Go Loud app, but obviously you can get us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you get your podcast. We timestamp the morning show for you, so you can scroll through the bits that you don't want to, or you can just listen to the whole thing, as most people do, it turns out. It is time now, though, for Bar Wars. Episode 1, as Owen Sheehan pits digestives up against rich teas.
You're welcome along to Bar Wars. This is the slot where we put one chocolate bar up against another bar, battle them out, and see who is the winner. Today we're starting by putting the plain digestive biscuit up against the plain rich tea biscuit. Yes, I know, neither of these things are technically bars, but f*** you, leave me alone. So what we're doing is we're putting Tesco own brand rich tea up against Tesco own brand digestive biscuits. You may be wondering why I've gone for Tesco own brand biscuits. Well, I could say to you that it's a great leveller, that we've got two of the same brands going toe to toe, but realistically, we're on the brink of another recession and I'm not spending £3 on a pack of biscuits, half of which will end up at the bottom of your cup of tea. I'm going to start with the digestives. We're going to give these both a score out of a 100, a percentage score, starting with Tesco own brand digestives. Reduced fat, always a good start. Crumbly and crunchy, carefully baked for a dunkable golden treat. Absolutely luscious sounding sentence there by everybody at Tesco. I should say this is the last packet of plain digestives that were available on the shelf in Tesco. Basically, move on over hand sanitizer, move on over toilet roll. We've now got a new king in town, the new thing that everybody wants, but nobody can get. Just about to do the thing where you open the biscuit from the top of the packet, and then I realized I'm not a complete monster. The tear here, so many crumbs immediately. These have been battered and bruised. They were of such high demand in Tesco, I would not be surprised if these biscuits were subject of a fight. And I've actually just got the crummy residue of a big brawl. Okay, here we go. Look, I'm not even going to pull out a full biscuit there because there is no full biscuits in this. This is a disaster.
That's perfect. You can see why people are fighting over this. They're good and they're sweet and the digestive. It is what it is. You knew what you were getting. I said I wouldn't come in here with any preconceived notions, but it's impossible to not. It's an iconic part of our society, the digestive biscuit. Without it, we would crumble. With it, I guess we do crumble. And for that reason, I'm giving the digestives 68%. I think it's a strong score. The digestive biscuit is like the electric blanket for all of us. It will not wow you. It will not do anything special, but it will make you feel warm and it will make you feel comfortable and it will make you feel like you're at home. And a digestive biscuit makes me feel like I belong again. I don't know that I ever feel like I was a pariah, but I feel like I belong again. So thank you to the digestive biscuit. 68%, an excellent score. On to the rich tea biscuit. Again, Tesco own brand rich tea biscuit. Reduced fat, smooth and snappy. Carefully baked for a dunkable, lightly malty treat. So no preconceived notions here whatsoever. But I will say that Prince William did use rich tea biscuits in his wedding cake. So whether or not that'll come into things, we'll see. So the rich tea biscuit, a staple of English society. Again, a lot of crumbs here. But you can tell there's been less of a fight here for the rich tea biscuits in the shop. Like an unwanted child, the rich tea biscuit. But as I say, no preconceived notions about the rich tea. Definitely not going to allow my opinion that it's the worst biscuit in the world to get into my head. Definitely not going to allow myself to remember the fact that Prince William used it in his wedding cake. 2%. 2%. That's it. Crap biscuit. Awful. Worst thing that's ever been invented. The most pathetic biscuit I've ever experienced. And we all knew this. I knew this before entering this. I knew that when you go for a rich tea biscuit, it's actually false advertising because it is basically a cracker. The rich tea is the food equivalent of social distancing. Cold, empty, and entirely unfulfilling. 2% is what I give this. The worst biscuit ever invented, and it is a shame on our society that we allowed the English to bring these into our country. I don't have a cup of tea with me, but you know that a digestive would hold up longer. This thing would get absolutely destroyed to pieces by even lukewarm tea. And really, one winner, the digestive today with a score of 68%, beating the rich tea biscuit of 2%. An absolute hammering.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. Off the ball.
But when I got to Liverpool, I thought, right, I've bought myself a nice Aston Martin. I pulled up at the lights alongside Roy Keane, of all people, and I had the shades on. I think I was listening to some Speed Garage. My arm was out the window. You know, I was having myself. And then Roy gave me that look that he's given many of people in his time. And as he sped off into the distance, I was sitting in this car, looked at myself in the mirror and thought, I need to get rid of this.
Off the ball. Weeknights from 7 and weekends from 1. This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM.
Chris Martin.
Oh, you're kidding me!
September.
Kyle Lafferty.
Are you joking me?
Welcome along to the shoutiest segment on Irish radio and a multitude of other platforms. It's the scintillating, it's the stupefying, it's the splendido crappy quiz. Every Friday, but coming to you on Thursday, this week, we pit three of Team Off the Ball up against each other in our quiz of sporting factoids at the end of the week. Allow me to welcome tonight's contestants. Our first contestant today is the King of Outrage, and this week he's outraged with the Prime Minister of New Zealand for suggesting that the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny are essential workers. "What are you thinking?" he shouted at the TV last night. "We don't know where that stupid rabbit has been. I don't want him anywhere near my kids." Give it up for Adrian, who's your daddy, Barry?
What happened?
Come on.
It's fallen flat.
Exactly what he said happened.
We are welcome, Adrian. Good to have you back.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
We are welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm a champ, just in case it needs pointing out to the audience.
No, I think you'll find that I'm the reigning champion with one of the most crushing performances seen in the modern day crappy quiz. Have we had anybody in recent times get to double figures alone?
Don't think so, actually. Who cares? Impressive. 11. It was 11 points. Got all the rapid fire questions correct. It was a sight to behold. But you're here today to put a stop to that. Our next contestant is looking forward to a more chilled out Easter this weekend than he's usually used to. His formative years during Easter weekend were spent crucifying the cans on the Friday, hitting the clubs of Ballyhaunus on the Saturday, before waking up in a cave on the Sunday, pushing a boulder aside and rising from the dead. Give it up for Nathan Nate Dog Murphy.
Tell you, there were nights in Midas nightclub in Ballyhaunus that weren't too dissimilar to that.
Midas.
Did it open at midnight on a Friday night? On Good Friday?
Yeah, I think it did. No, there was another nightclub, a smaller one, I think, that opened at midnight on a Friday. I don't ever really remember doing that. Cans much. Didn't feel like there was much of a thing where you'd like have a load of cans and then hit into town at midnight on a Friday.
No, cans used to be the same price as pints. That was the problem when we were in college.
You get served in Ballyhaunus when you're about 14, so I'm sure it was all the
way. Well, that is true. Six cans of Dutch gold for Friday. Fiver.
So Midas nightclub, where everything you touch turned to gold?
Fail. I don't know if there's an appropriate answer for that.
Right.
Hashtag me too.
Let's round up our introductions. Our final contestant today is a man who wanted a less wordy intro to the quiz last time. Round one, the boring questions round, never multiple choice. Question one for you, Adrian. Cork got the Mount Rushmore treatment on OTBAM this week with Roy Keane easing into the reckoning. Can you name the schoolboy / junior club he played for as a kid?
Ah, come on. Dear God.
Rockmount.
Correct. Seriously, on. I know there's a documentary named after it and it's very, very famous, but who knows? Strange
Listen,
things
you just
happened.
Asked me to name a schoolboy club that like some random player played for and I've been able to pull it out of the hat, so move on. Champ.
Good knowledge. Nathan, this question came in for you from Cahill O'Rourke on Twitter a few weeks back, but we've been going year by year, so we never got around to it. We'll get around to it today. The Republic of Ireland senior men's team have played home games in 9 venues around Ireland. Can you name 8 of them?
Woof.
Oh!
With that, he's gone.
I'm back.
Okay.
But I missed the question completely.
So the Republic of Ireland senior men's team have played home games in 9 venues around Ireland. Can you name 8 of them?
All right. Are Lansdowne Road and the Aviva Stadium 2 different places?
No, they would be one.
Okay. Dunfermline Park.
Correct.
Thomond Park.
3.
Turner's Cross.
4.
These are fully capped senior internationals.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Crow sure, Park. Why not?
Yeah, 5. Fully capped,
Fully capped.
Because I remember being at a game at Dalyman Park during Trapattoni's reign when the Republic of Ireland played. But
this,
it may be
this
the
is the point of the question where Nathan just
Dalyman Park
branches off.
You've already said Dalyman, haven't already. You?
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
You've said Lansdowne Road, Crow Park, Dalyman, Turner's Cross and Thomond. That's your 5 so far.
Yeah, you're done. You're toast. You're
you
out of there.
3 more.
Not going to get them. Come on.
No, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Senior men's internationals. Turner's Cross.
Come on, we're going to need an answer. We're going to need at least one more to buy yourself a little bit more time here, Nathan. This is outrageous, the time you're
it's
taking.
It's struggling big time, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm surprised by this.
Yeah.
On the island of Ireland or in the 26 counties?
Republic of Ireland.
No, you can't.
Windsor Park.
You can't.
Windsor Park.
No, wrong.
Windsor Park. Windsor Park.
Game over.
No, they play Northern Ireland in Windsor Park.
Tala.
Not a home game, Nathan.
What?
Not a, clearly home not a home game. Games? Like,
yeah, you did say. It's too late. You're out.
You're gone.
Would you believe? Would you believe the Republic of Ireland have had all their home games in the 26 counties? They are Lansdowne Road, Croke Park, Daly Mount. You forgot the RDS, Turner's Cross, Thomond Park. Shit. You forgot Tolka Park, which is another one I thought. And in the last two, were probably the last two. You might have got the Mardyke, and then the toughest one of the lot. Anybody else? Flower Lodge.
Belfield?
Yeah, I see.
Flower Lodge.
Yeah. So unfortunately, you don't score.
RDS, I should have got that.
Jer, question one for you. Sunderland Till I Die season 2 has been a raging success on Netflix. Can you name the last Republic of Ireland footballer to play for the club?
Aidan McGeady.
Correct.
Boom. Come on. Those questions are ridiculous compared to my question.
They are. Good question.
I mean, if only you were a football, an international football commentator, don't I? You know,
exactly.
Like, lean slightly in your direction.
Oh, come on.
When we do football get questions... Man. When we do get questions in, Nathan, they are generally, a couple of them are directed specifically for you. So you've got to respect the audience for wanting to challenge you. So thank you, Kyle O'Rourke, for getting in touch with that one.
I mean, that was a good question. I should have got the RDS.
It's a good question. Round two is the Guinness Pour Round. Yes, indeed. It's a long weekend coming up. And crappy quiz contestants have proved that they have the attention span of a goldfish. They're having none of this year-by-year trivia anymore, but it will return next week. For now, let's let these lads play in their corner and do what they do best. In this round, they will have to pour a pint of Guinness from a can. The best pint.
I didn't know anything about this. I definitely don't have one of these. I mean,
me too.
That's not how I go to work every day.
Just to clarify here, the best pint will win 2 points. And shout out to Siobhan Foley on Twitter for getting in touch with the idea.
Sorry, just to clarify, a couple of things. Are we all pouring at the same time?
No, we will start with Adrian. We let him go for a couple of seconds, then on to Nathan, who'll go for a couple of seconds, and on to Jer, and then we'll get into the settling period together.
However,
and we should have advertised this in advance so that Guinness might have given us a load of good stuff for free.
No, absolutely. You all have to go out and buy your own cans. Absolutely.
They can retrospectively. Well, Nathan came as part of his giant mother load of booze that arrived during the diet.
No, it didn't. I actually had to go and
Can I just ask, what are we getting points awarded on here? Because you can't actually taste them. I'd like to know in advance what your criteria are.
You're not going to be able to see the quality of my pint because there's writing on my glass. That's the problem.
Well, that's not my problem, is it?
I mean, it is your problem because you won't be able to see how amazing my pint is.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. It could be so
What's
good.
What's the criteria on? Come on.
Good sized head. Good. Ew. Like the rest of it is just good. Like just good quality, good looking pint. And that's it, really. That is it. A good head on it. It's all we need. Adrian, you're starting us off. Are you ready?
Should I give it a go, like your man on the internet there? Should I give that a go? Because I'm like,
do you think that can get you the most effective pint? Like, absolutely.
I'm going to give it a go. Yeah, to hell with it.
Okay, let's go. So Adrian Barry, first up, pouring his pint of Guinness.
So what did he do again? You just tip it in like this.
I know you're disease phobic, Adrian. Yes.
No.
Oh. Okay, so he started something there. He started. Nathan, you're up. Let's get you underway with this while Adrian's working away in the background. Oh, he's gone. He's let it a minute before he stopped it. He has a Guinness glass. I thought none of us had Guinness glasses here. And his camera's gone.
With my name on it. Settling nicely.
That's not fair.
That's a new... I think the guy used a different type of Guinness glass where the can doesn't go down quite as far.
Right. Well, Jer, it's up to you and your five lamps glass. What can you do for us? The can is open. The foam is out. Time to turn that baby upside down.
Oh, no.
The sun is shining. It does feel like it's a little bit too early for Guinness, but
no,
I guess
not.
I have to go with this.
Right, Adrian, we're going to need your next step here.
Can I apologize in advance to Cora Staunton, who I have to interview straight after this?
Okay.
Our Better Call Saul recap season 3 is going to be lit.
Adrian is pulling it out.
Heyo.
I think it's fine. There's a good head on it.
Oh, this is good.
Nathan is looking good. Nathan is looking great. Jer, we're going to need you to catch up here soon.
Oh, that looks glorious.
That does not look bad. I'm not going to lie. Nathan looks good.
Oh.
Jer in the five lamps.
Absolutely beautiful.
Wowzers.
Bring that bad boy up to the camera.
No, but he can't be giving him bonus points just because he's got an actual Guinness glass. That's not our fault.
Well,
with my name on it.
We'll We'll have to see once we get a good close up.
This looks exceptional. I'm going to take it out of the double glass here so you can get the full.
Adrian, looks like now something you'd be drinking at about 7 p.m. on Sunday evening at Letcher Picnic, and you're questioning your choices in life.
Adrian, that's not bad. That's not bad. That's not bad, actually.
She's a beauty. She's a beauty, on. She's still
a plastic
settling.
Glass. Nathan, let's see what you've got.
It hasn't fully settled yet.
Okay, yeah, so. But don't be giving him extra points because he's in the Guinness glass. Oh, it's like a bishop's collar. He's ruined it.
You have. That head is way too big.
He's made an absolute shambles.
No,
way
no,
too
no,
big.
No.
It's a
that's
bit like his Mayo Mount Rushmore. It's a shambles.
that's
way too small. The head on that is way too small.
Lads, I'm not...
What are you talking about?
There's a winner right here.
What are you talking about?
Yeah,
lads. What are you talking about?
I can crown the winner here. Adrian Barry.
That's perfect.
That's it.
That is a lot. Look at that.
It looks perfect.
It looks fine.
Mine is...
Cheers, lads.
Adrian Barry in the plastic glass gets the 2 points.
Look at that.
Oh, look how small his head is.
This isn't... Mine is still settling. This is not over.
Mine is perfect.
Well, let me see yours, Nathan. Yours got a hollow in the middle. Mine is actually bigger than a pint glass. That was my problem.
That's
good. That is a good point.
That is tasty and tempting.
Well done, lads. That was a roaring success. Thanks again to Siobhan Foley for the shout on that round. It may come back again sometime soon. Round three is... Sorry, go for it, Jer. He's just having a sip.
Oh, that's good.
Round three is the goodbye Mick again round. This round of the Test for Knowledge on the second tenure of Mick McCarthy.
Jesus, don't talk Mick McCarthy with Gilroy after he's had half a pint.
I might tell you the truth, what? Yeah. Never a good manager. Never a good manager. A championship manager at best. Oh.
I'm going to regret this at about 4 o'clock today. No, I will be
asleep in about an hour.
Yeah.
Having had a fight with all of your work colleagues on Zoom. And another thing.
Question three for you, Adrian.
Oh, that is good.
How many points did I get for that, by the way? That's
2.
Look at the layering on it. Look at the layering on it.
Here.
Good layering. For a plastic glass, that's a fine looking pint.
Each lacing.
That is beautiful.
Like they're all beautiful.
I look like the greatest corporate whore of all time right now.
They all have lovely heads.
That's no different to any other day, Nathan, to be fair to you.
Adrian, which of the following formations was never used by Mick McCarthy during his second tenure as Ireland boss? Was it A, 4-4-2, B, 4-5-1, C, 4-3-1-2, or D, 4-3-3?
4-3-1-2 or 4-3-3, like what's the... I'm going to go with probably 4-3-1-2.
Correct. Never used. 4-3-3
was used.
Have
you watched back every single minute of every Mick McCarthy game?
I was going
by... To be able to stand over the fact that he never, at any stage of the match, played a 4-3-1-2.
I should have rephrased that. But starting formations, according to soccerway.com, which has all the formations laid out. 4-4-2 was played against Gibraltar at home. 4-5-1 was played against Denmark away. And 4-3-3 played against Georgia at home. I don't recall...
And what about his first spell in charge?
This is only to do with the second...
Listen to the question. Come on.
Question three.
Who did he play 4-3-3 against?
Georgia at home.
Listen,
no.
Move on.
Nathan, listen, on to
like,
you.
Will the quiz ever go past where Nathan isn't bitching and moaning?
Daddy, I thought you said you wouldn't drink at lunchtime anymore.
you promised me yesterday.
Yeah. I thought we'd spoken about this.
I mean, you can project your own conversations there, lads, but... My kids see me drinking at home all the time. It's mature attitude towards this. Yeah. Get out, squad.
Nathan, question for you.
You're back behind the Google machine.
Nathan, can you name the three FAI CEOs during Mick McCarthy's second tenure as Ireland manager?
Gary Owens.
Yeah.
Is he struggling
when he took over, John Delaney.
Yeah.
And
come on, ding, 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 ding. Time up.
Noel Mooney.
No. Noel Mooney was general manager. Raya
Walsh.
The
operations director. What's
Raya Walsh? Yeah, was CEO for a while.
Was she? No, I thought she had a different title.
Interim CEO.
She did after a time, but she was CEO for a while. Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, or whatever his get out of jail terms and conditions like, apply. What is he looking up?
Do you think
what
he
is he googling?
Do you think he ever
his computer?
A wrong answer.
What is Nathan doing? Oh, look at his guilty face. Look at him. He is disqualified. Seize his point. Seize his point. That's the only way to dismiss him out of any.
More beer for Gilroy. More beer.
Sure. Who is the only player to be sent off during Mick McCarthy's second tenure as Ireland manager?
Come on. These questions are so bloody easy.
The ones that you can't get right.
You'll be happy to know there is no round four today, Nathan. It's straight into the rapid fires, or into the numbers after this. So
what?
Give me that hint there.
Straight into the numbers. The hint? No. Just give us the name of the player who got sent off.
No hint.
It's easy. Is he like, was he the captain at some point?
No hint.
Give me an answer.
Seamus Coleman.
Is that your answer, or are you just thinking out loud?
No, that's not my answer, because you would have said correct. So I'm just thinking out loud. Seamus Coleman.
Correct.
Oh.
Yeah, it got sent off against Switzerland. Okay, at the end of round three, it is Adrian 4, Jer 2, Nathan 0. Round four is...
Am I not
the...
on a five?
No, you couldn't possibly have been on five. There's only been three rounds, and one of them was 2 points.
Oh, yeah, fair.
Round four is the fun-free magic number round. Contestants get 3 points for getting the number exactly right, and if nobody manages that, the nearest contestant who doesn't go bust gets 2 points. The second closest then gets 1 point. So, if you don't mind, give us the following number. Do we have pen and paper?
Yeah.
Good stuff. The number of players whose goal-scoring tally was more than one goal during Nick McCarthy's second tenure as Ireland boss, plus the number of All-Ireland medals won by Christy Ring, plus the number of NBA teams Michael Jordan played for, plus the number of consecutive All-Irelands won by Dublin in women's football after 2019. Your 30 seconds expire when Sinatra sings Bright Shiny Beads.
After 2019?
What?
Since 20, sorry, how many? After the 2019 All-Ireland.
What?
Was what?
Okay. How many consecutive All-Irelands have Dublin won in women's football right now? How many teams in the NBA has Michael Jordan played for? The number of All-Ireland medals won by Christy Ring. And then the number of players who scored more than one goal under Mick McCarthy during his second watch as Ireland manager. A couple of seconds, lads. Pens down.
Right.
Hands down.
Come on, Nathan. Hands down. That Googling. Stop Nathan. It.
Nathan,
what have you got, Nathan?
12.
12. Adrian?
14.
14. Adrian's got 12.
12.
12.
The answer is 13.
Oh, ooh, yes.
So it is 2 points apiece for Nathan and Adrian.
Fuck.
Adrian is flying at the moment.
Is it not four in a row?
You know, and I was actually going to go for one more there, but look at.
Yeah, I got everything right, except the Dubs, and they get everything wrong.
So you didn't get everything right; you got one wrong.
Okay, let's go through them. The number of players whose goal scoring tally was above
zero,
one goal, zero. Yeah, no one scored more than one goal. The number of All Ireland medals won by Christy Ring.
Six.
Eight.
Six.
Eight. Look at these two. Look at these two Luddites. Pearls before swine. Look at them. No,
you've
no sense of knowledge or history or anything.
You literally spent, you spent last week.
Everybody knows Christy Ring won 8 All Irelands. Oh my God. You West Brits.
I think we've learned one thing. The idea that we had of doing the crappy quiz after a rake of pints may not be one to go to go in.
The number of NBA teams Michael Jordan has played for?
Two.
Two, I put in.
Two, yeah. Bulls and Wizards.
Congratulations. Well done.
And then Dublin have won 3 consecutive All-Ireland women's titles.
3, yeah.
So that brings you to 13. Right. The scores at the moment are Adrian 6, Jer 4, Nathan 2. We're on to the final.
How's Jer on 4?
The boys.
How was he on four? That's an excellent question.
Oh, that's... sorry. Jerry's only on two.
Yeah.
It's 6-2-2.
So who goes first, me or Jer?
Adrian goes first.
Are you drinking as well there? Did you have a cheeky pint while you were...
and then between toss the coin earlier between Adrian and Nathan, and Adrian won.
No, it's Jer and Nathan. How many of you had?
Between Jer and Jer. Nathan. Nathan won that coin toss.
You're literally making this up.
That used to exist as like, oh, maybe that actually happened. I think you've just fully pulled the veil off there.
Oh, I'll have them down on my sheet. So we're going from Adrian to Nathan to Jer, and that's our order.
That's
Adrian.
The same sheet that you had the last time. You just need to update the sheet and go, okay, you know, by the process of elimination, he won that coin toss. There's actually a greater chance that I will win the next coin toss.
Well, expecting 50-50 is not always a good outcome. Adrian, are you ready?
This would take some bottle job for Adrian not to win it. This will
champ,
be
champ, champ. Here we come. Come on, let's do it.
Here we go.
Bottle jobs.
Adrian Barry, your 40 seconds starts now. What club is Aidan McGeady on loan at now?
Ipswich.
No, Charlton. Who topped Ireland's Rugby World Cup pool in 2003?
France.
No, Australia. In what year will the next Summer Olympics take place, Ger?
2021.
Correct. Which city is set to host the Olympics after Tokyo?
Paris.
Correct. Name the Arsenal manager before Mikel Arteta.
Arsene Wenger.
No.
God damn it!
Emery. In what year did Padraig Harrington win his first major, Adrian?
2009.
No. 07. What county is Sheffield United's John Egan from, Nathan?
Cork.
Correct. Time is up. So.
Ah, come on!
Time is up. Adrian holds on for the win. It's finished. Adrian, 4 points. Jer, 3 points. Nathan, 2 points. Congratulations, Adrian. Champ, doing it again. Is champ. That three in a row?
I've said this before. We need to extend the time in the rapid fire. That's a nonsense. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 questions in. Come on.
How many did you get there in the rapid fire, Nathan?
Well, right. I got as many as you
many
got.
You get wrong,
I got more,
actually,
wait, I got more than you got. More than you got.
He's dropped out.
You literally didn't get a single question right in the rapid fire.
So, but overall, I ended up with how many points on? Just to recap.
Four.
Hang on. Did Nathan end up with two?
Oh, yeah. So I see how the quiz works. Those who end up on most points win.
They both got two points for finishing in the numbers range. Should they not get a point and a half?
It wouldn't make any difference.
Also,
would.
I'm sorry.
Would.
A quiz.
You've been on four and I've been on three.
No, listen, also,
champ,
I think
champ,
I,
champ.
I do think myself and Jer have very good reason to dispute this, because the great thing about quizzes, and we love quizzes, and we love the crappy quiz, is that there's nothing subjective about it. You either know the answer or you don't. So,
what are you worried about? What are you worried about?
You're slurring your words.
Well, you're not
going
to make any sense now. It's like...
Adrian,
you either know
points.
The answer or you don't.
You either know the answer or you don't. I mean, that's
Adrian, yeah, but you got two extra points for a pint of Guinness. But
yes! Sorry, I just remembered. That was obscene. But you can't even see. That was completely obscene.
You both murdered your pints.
What's next week? Like, what's next week? What are you going to start handing points out for next week? So that was your opinion, badly judged opinion, because his camera angle is grainier than ours. So, like, it's an outrage.
Oh, no. It was
so you didn't actually answer any more questions than anybody else.
Have you ever lost a quiz where you haven't bitched and moaned about it, where you've actually sat back and said, listen, fair enough.
No, I think we'd all agree. This is the most... I didn't lose the quiz part.
I actually won the quiz part.
No, Adrian's
argument at this point, argument Dublin's dominance. Like, the last three quizzes I've partaken in, one, WWW.
Well, he just keeps making up nonsensical rounds. Just do the quiz. Cheers, lads.
Chin-chin.
Chin-chin, indeed. A pleasure, lads. Enjoy your long weekend.
I'm really not sure that that merits any further discussion. If you would like to complain about anything you've just heard, then don't bother. 0879-180-180 is the WhatsApp number. If you want to get in touch with us, you can use the hashtag OTBAM. Let's turn our attention. Owen, you've disgraced yourself there, by the way. Let's turn our attention to Off the Couch. We're trying to get the nation healthy after watching us drink pints. I realize it's like night. We recorded that yesterday afternoon, just for in case anybody had any doubts about it. Ray Moyle, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
You're on the vote of the Limerick jury.
You obviously are a boxer. Should have been on Mayo's Mount Rushmore. We might get to that in a moment. I can send you Nathan Murphy's home address if you'd like call around.
I'm going to pick with Nathan Murphy, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah. Okay. Your video is great. I can actually picture myself doing that with the kids and teaching them how to box this afternoon. So, what are you doing as an athlete at the moment to try and make sure that you don't have muscle wastage and that you do manage to keep ticking over?
Okay, so I am trying to get a run in every second day, and actually I'm blessed to have, so I have a little personal home gym that I have all year round, but it's actually in Westport, and we share it between a few friends. But since I'm homebound now at the minute, I was able to bring the equipment home. So I'm fairly up-to-date gym with rower, spin bike, kettlebells and barbells and weights. So I'm fairly up-to-date with that. So I'm able to relatively stay in shape, in theory, definitely in theory. And so I try and get a session in once a day, regardless whether it's a run or it's a short weight session. I know no one's going to be killing themselves doing any training at the minute because we don't know when we need to peak. We don't know when we're going to be back. So it's just important to, more so for the head. I think the position we're all in at the minute, we're all cooked up at home and no one knows really what's happening. There's no security with anything. So I think just to get a bit of training done, enjoy it. And it's for the head mainly more than anything.
One of the very first pieces that we did was with Andy Dunn, who talked about how hormones are released when you do physical activity. You obviously know this better than anybody. It's like your body is your job as a professional boxer. So from that perspective, do you get the dopamine hits? Do you get the hormones coursing through your veins when you do exercise? And if that is the case, then, you know, times like this, you probably benefit from the dopamine a bit more than the rest of us, even, because you kind of need it. You have it every day, all the time.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, professional boxing isn't, you don't do this because you love getting hit in the face and you love the hard training and the struggle on your own. Professional boxing and boxing in general, you get a serious hit from talking about it, from actually physically putting yourself under that strain, from sparring with other opponents and getting the better of them. You know, it's a rush and a hit that you're constantly striving for. So when you don't have it, you have to figure out a way of getting it. So you don't realize how much I do rely on it, or boxers don't realize how much they love it until it's taken away from them. It's been taken away from me for nearly a year and a half now since I haven't been able to fight, but I've been able to find the ordinary or the extraordinary maybe in the more ordinary things. So trying to get up to Dublin sparring and trying to enjoy the gym, I'm starting to love that now, whereas before it was all about the fights. The training was only coming in my way. I just wanted to fight and fight. Whereas I had to pull back the reins a little bit now because I've been so inactive that I had to take the glory out of the training now. So I'm enjoying my training now as well. But it's definitely, I can't, like, after I came back from Boston when everything went shut down overnight, obviously I was very disappointed. I was in, like, I did nothing for a week. I sat down, binged on Netflix, ate my body weight three times over, and I wasn't sleeping right, and it's very hard to be able to enjoy anything there and then. So I picked up the toys again, as I said, out at the pram, and I started training every day. And ever since then, now I can see the goodness in everything, and I'm trying to think of new challenges and trying to help other people now, and trying to be positive, because we every time on the news, it's at the minute it's bad news that's coming. So we need to try and counteract that somewhere.
Can we just, in case anybody is unfamiliar, you were due to fight for the first time in a long time, and then the fight ended up getting cancelled because of the coronavirus. That's essentially what happened.
That's it. So I was out of the ring a year and a half, and I was geared to come back. This is my second comeback, which the first one didn't go ahead with visa issues. So this one was second, and it was perfectly primed for St. Patrick's weekend in Boston. Sellout show. I was fighting for the New England for the New England region title. I was fighting another Irish guy called Larry Friars, and the day before the weigh-in, the show got pulled due to the coronavirus. So, like, if it got pulled a week before it, we would have managed it. But I was actually in Boston, and I was on weight. And for any boxer that knows, to get down to fighting weight is harder than anything. So it was just pulled at the last minute. But if it was pulled a week, as I said, a week before it, it wouldn't have any effect really on me at all. But just to be so close and for it to be taken away from me and not knowing when it can be done. Not when we can, when I can fight again, you know. It's a little bit hard with that, but again, we're all alive and we're still here, and we can figure out other ways to enjoy these days.
Yeah, with that must only add to the actual sense of guilt. So we've been talking to a lot of elite sports people, and they have to be selfish people to get to the point where they put their careers ahead of absolutely everything. And at some level, elite sports people were able to practice more, they were able to take more pain than the normal population, as well as being more talented. So on top of all that, then you feel like this opportunity which you've worked for the last year and a half gets taken away from you. There has to be a selfish kind of element going, ah, Jesus Christ. Well, at the same time, the rest of the world is going to shit. And so you have the guilt of feeling selfish in the midst of a global pandemic. It's a more difficult situation, I would argue, than a lot of people who are just getting on with it at this stage.
Well, especially when I came back from Boston, I had to self-isolate. I did 10 days on my own. My wife moved out. She moved out to her home house. And so shit hit the fan, really, when I came home. No one here, everyone gone. And I was feeling sorry for myself. As I said, it took a week. But then I quickly realized, when you see the amount of hurt out there in the world coming from this pandemic, and families losing loved ones, and they can't see them, and they can't visit them, can't bury them, you know, surely that it puts a fight into context, you know. So I can't be too selfish. Now, I'm selfish in my own training, but I would never express that. And I think everything is put into perspective now, that a fight is a fight and a sport at the end of the day. And I was looking for that. But if that opportunity doesn't come, or it wasn't able to come that time, I have to figure out other ways of expressing myself.
Yeah, I kind of, the reason I was asking about that selfishness was because I wanted to ask that question where you talked about finding the extraordinary in the ordinary. Like your experience of binging on Netflix and eating your body weight three times over, I'd say everybody has done pretty much exactly the same thing. Layer on a level of drinking as well, and that's probably exactly how most people have been coping with this. You at least have got back to training, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing Off the Couch, to try and get people off the couch. So, but what was the turning point for you where you did kind of pivot a little bit and go, actually, I need now to recenter myself and to stop being selfish and start thinking about the outside world and start finding the extraordinary in the ordinary. What caused that for you?
Yeah, so it's a complex answer. You know, there's not one thing that did it. But so when I say I was on weight making fights, so my body was in great shape and I was in a great position. And then suddenly to start to be eating very clean food in small portions to being able to eat everything in sight, you know, that's automatically your body is going to transform in the worst way possible. And then your head, you feel guilty, you feel like you've let yourself down to get into this shape after like 3 days. So like 3 days I was in the best shape of my life, and 3 days after that, I was maybe in the worst shape of my life and didn't know where to go. So there's a few things. So I actually have a baby on the way in June, first baby, myself and my wife. So that's exciting time. So we can't dwell on too much what's gone. So we have to keep looking forward to that. A very good friend of mine, Des Ryan, he's my sponsor as well. He reached out to me and said he wants me to train him. So I send sessions to him and his family every day. So I have to physically do the sessions, get up there and get my head into the game to be able to teach other people. So that was one thing. And then just, I'm not one to dwell too much anyway on things or things that might have been. You know, we have to keep moving forward with all this. But your body changing and people asking you to help them out, I think they were the two main things. And the baby on the way that we need to keep positive for as well. So they're the three factors, I suppose, but I'm sure there was more to it, but maybe they're the main ones.
Ray, you're obviously doing Off the Couch for us this lunchtime. It's our fitness show here on Off the Ball. I must ask you about your other fitness exhibition that was published on social media recently. You did 1,000 press ups in the space of 1 hour. The problem was, the problem that everybody had with this race, that this was published on April the 1st.
Yeah, and if you do look back over my social media accounts, there might be one serious post to five jokes or whatever. But in, like, I can't believe, number one, how many people haven't questioned me on it. No, but I want to. But I'm serious. I have, and I did do it, if you believe me or not. But I know there is a good few that have questioned me on it, but not as many as I definitely thought. And I've challenged a lot of people to it, and to my knowledge, no one has done it. The closest, some guy online on Instagram, I think it was, and I think he's from Scotland. I think he got 907. Was it the closest he got? The average is probably 500 to 700 what people are coming in, and I don't think I got the respect I did when I launched it first. In terms, I think it took people to try it and do it, and then say, "Wow, that was a challenge."
So it's 17 push-ups every minute for 59 minutes.
Yes.
And you posted a picture of yourself there on social media as well afterwards. It looks insanely tough, or it sounds insanely tough, I think.
Like, if you see that picture, if you can look into my eyes in that picture, you can see there's hurt, there's pain. I've went through hell in that hour to get there. And it was just unfortunate that it had to be April the 1st that I posted it. You know, I feel like... the boy that cried wolf, you know, I think it's coming back to bite me here now. But I've been talking to a friend of mine, and I think this is a challenge that I've set out that no one has done over the last week. And I think I do need, so being in the public eye, I think I do need to prove myself. I think it's only fair that the amount of people that have tried that, I could have thought of this challenge on my head and just sent it out to people and made them go through pain. But I think people want to see me going through pain as well. So I think I'm going to do it live maybe next weekend, and I'm going to figure out the best way of doing it. And maybe if I can, I might add a charity or two to it. Just to, people need to see me in pain. I want to be able to show that I'm not a blackguard full time, and I think we can have a bit of crack with it.
Listen, well, we could stream it for you.
Absolutely.
We could stream that for you, Ray.
I do need to prove myself, because even Joe from yourselves and Off the Ball, he rang me about doing a workout for Off the Couch. And he said, you did that 1,000 push-ups. Was that April Fool's, was it? Joe, he questioned me on it straight away. So I need to clear my name. And hopefully I can do it again.
I feel it's the least we could do, Ray, having blackguarded you the way that Nathan Murphy did when he didn't put you on Mayo's Mount Rushmore. I thought it was, you know, as so many of your colleagues in the boxing world pointed out, boxing is a sport that takes place all around the world. You rose to being the best in Ireland. You rose to being the best in Europe. That is surely worthy of a place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore.
Best in the world in 2008.
I mean, come on, Nathan. What are you thinking?
Where's Nathan? I have him here. He is four footballers on that list. Surely there has to be some room. Mayo is a great county of athletes, of Olympians. We have all sports here at the top level, and he picks four footballers, that three GAA footballers and a soccer player who did all his achievements while earning money. Whereas the rest of them were amateur. I was amateur when I did my winning. So surely I have a shout somewhere.
I would agree with you, right? I'm on your side on this one, actually. Who are you taking off?
I'm not sure. Cora and Liam McHale definitely to stay on. Kieran McDonnell is probably the biggest icon in Mayo GAA history with the green and red. Kevin Kilbane is a very good friend of mine. But I don't think he misses out on the criteria, as he was a professional athlete. He was doing it for as a job, not for maybe the love of it or for a sport. Whereas the rest of them were. Now, I don't know do I'd want to take him out either, but I'm not going to take him out because I'm not going to be controversial. I think he's definitely deserving of it, but I think there's questions to be asked. But to my detriment, I'm not finished yet. I have a little bit left in my career, and maybe when it's done, I might be able to replace some of them. But at the minute, I'm going to leave it as it is. But I'm going to put a question mark on Kevin Kilbane.
You're coming for Kilbane's spot.
Yeah, I'm coming for his spot, but he's safe for now.
I mean, you know, Ray, if you wanted to come for Nathan Murphy in particular, like, I mean, it would be a bit unfair to organise a white-collar boxing fight. Nathan was going to do white-collar boxing one time, but he injured his ribs. You know, rib injury is one of those ones where they don't actually x-ray you because they say there's no point. You're just going to get better with it. So you can't verify if it's true or not is really my point. But he pulled out of the it would be unfair to put you in the ring with Nathan Murphy, although, I mean, I would definitely pay $9.99 for you.
It wouldn't be too unfair. If we could get a vote on that. Do you know what? I'd rather do that live than the push-ups, to agree with him.
Well, as a great leveler, Ray, would be you to do your 1,000 push-ups, then get into the ring with Nathan Murphy. That would probably have the playing field.
I've been honest with you, I'd be the severe underdog after that, definitely, right. Because it took me 3 or 4 days to come back to myself. I was having nightmares sleeping after these push-ups. It was an insane hour. I can't even explain what it was like. Kneeling down, looking at your clock, every second ticking over, and doubting yourself constantly to get these push-ups in. It was horrible. But I'm willing to do it again to prove myself, as I do, and I want to raise a few pounds for a worthy charity that will maybe benefit from it. So...
Well, let's try and organize that. We can broadcast it on all our channels, and you can promote whatever charity you think is the right one to do. Ray, this has been great. The off the couch is great, and I'm glad that it helps, that you helping people is helping you as well, because I think that's kind of what needs to happen. Everybody kind of needs to help each other at the moment if we're all going to get through this together. Always great to chat with you, Ray. Stay well. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. We'll talk to you.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Right, that's Ray Moylett. Always a pleasure to have on the show. What are we at? 9:46 this morning here on OTBM. Our player ratings are back in a moment, where we're looking at season 3 of Better Call Saul. First, though, we've been working with the final year journalism students in DCU. About a month ago, they caught up with the Dublin footballer Michael Darren McCauley to talk about the work that he's been doing in the north inner city of Dublin. This is a report by Elizabeth Malloy, Katie Lowry and Johnny Lynham. Have a look.
Ballybock sits in the shadows of Croke Park. But for many of the kids growing up here, it can seem like a million miles away. Dublin footballer Michael Darren McCauley is the Sports and Engagement Officer for the North East Inner City Initiative, which was set up to regenerate this part of Dublin. And he wants to put sport at the heart of this community.
I suppose what we want is that no child or no adult or anyone in the area can say that there's nothing for us to do. Because there is. GAA was one that hadn't been big around the area. I suppose green fields are lacking around here, unfortunately, so they're a bit down the road. So that's the main hazard to that. But we set up a number of initiatives. In terms of we have a GAA academy, we're getting good numbers of that. Some great mix of Irish and international kids are coming to that. So that's kind of getting a ball in their hand early, from the ages of like 4 to 7 years old, and they're great fun, and that's going really well. Getting really good numbers of that.
Despite neighbouring the GAA's headquarters, many of the younger residents of Ballybock had never even stepped foot inside the stadium's grounds on Jones's Road. With the help of Croke Park, Michael Darren McCauley has worked to change this.
Croke Park can be quite helpful. They've been very good in terms of funding their own projects around here as well. And they're definitely interested in community welfare around here. So it's a huge kind of beacon in the area as well. It's one thing that we worked on was that a lot of children had never even been to Croke Park. You know, they can see it out the bedroom windows. That we worked at Croke Park and Dublin County Board, to be fair, to get tickets just for the kids around the area, just to get in just to see a game. It doesn't have to be an Ireland final, but just for them to know even what goes on in there. Which I thought was madness that they hadn't been there before. So that was a big one. And look, I suppose Croke Park can be kind of an epicenter for some of the goings on around here.
The streets of Ballybock are adorned with the faces of many heroes of Dublin football, both past and present. Michael Darrow wants to shine a light on the importance of the everyday hero in the Dublin 1 area.
We need role models across the board in terms of jobs, in terms of just being kind of proactive and productive. So that is really important. We want to highlight that there's a raft of people who are doing well for themselves. around this area, and they need to be seen to lead the way, I suppose, for the generation coming after them. In it, like, obviously I would have driven through this area a million times, and obviously with the football as well, but I suppose it's probably a lot of those Dublin lads that have driven through this area a million times but don't know the area, so it's nice to kind of to be embedded in it. I definitely feel embedded in it.
Okay, you're welcome along to the player ratings show. At the moment, we are binge-watching Better Call Saul, 2 weeks away from the finale, 2 weeks away from reviewing season 5. So right now, it is season 3. Jer's been binging it. I've been binging it. Joe, you've been watching it back or reading it back, I think. Does season 3 seem like an age ago for you?
Yeah, it was actually weird. Rewatched a bit of it last night, particularly the first episode, the last episode, and kind of a few of the key bits in between. But yeah, it was just amazing how enjoyable the series is, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Mm. Jerry, you've raced well ahead for me at this point, so you've got a well-rounded view. Yeah, you've got a well-rounded view at this point.
Yeah, it's hard to... I had to go and read the recap this morning because it was like 2 weeks ago or maybe a week and a half ago when we were watching this, but this season ends on a massive, dramatic coda. It's kind of like the end of the beginning. Mm-hmm. And everything else changes. Because the show is called Better Call Saul, right? But Saul Goodman only shows up really in the middle of this series, this season, and even then doesn't really exist in any meaningful way.
No, absolutely. Let's go back and let's have a listen to some of the major plot points from season 3.
Long story short, I am not crazy.
Jimmy McGill understands he broke the law. He's more than ready to face the consequences.
I'll be taking a brief sabbatical from the law.
I've got cash I can't spend.
I have you down as a logistics consultant.
Security consultant would be better.
Mesa Verde can wait.
It's not Mesa Verde. It's a new client. And if I mess this up, it's a former client.
I want an intimate witness to get my stuff over the border.
My father is a simple man.
I don't trust him.
From now on, there will be only one route for our products.
Call 911.
If I had to do it all over again, I would do some things differently.
You've never mattered all that much to me.
My brother is sick.
You want me to retire over this? The insurance? That's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Howard, I'm fine.
This is not what fine looks like.
So that is from Netflix season recap. And just a couple of the sounds in the middle there. You've obviously got Kim's car crash, something that wouldn't have been immediately evident from the sounds alone. You would have had Hector collapsing with a stroke. And then, of course, at the very end, you could possibly make out the sound of the flames flickering away inside Chuck's house as he knocks the lantern off his table after a fairly wild conclusion to season 3, I think it's fair to say. Like, Jerry, you were making the point just before we came on air that had this whole Chuck McGill thing been handled differently in season 3, it might have sat a lot more uneasily with us. But it seemed that the Better Call Saul writers had stopped taking the piss out of him, or had stopped making this kind of a subject of light relief. Now, I'm not sure if they ever went that far, but it certainly never felt in season 1 and season 2 that it would reach some sort of grave result as it did in season 3.
I think after a period of time, you realize that Kim Wexler is almost the character who plays the role of the audience in all this. She's the one who gets intoxicated by what Jimmy is up to and loves him as the rogue that he is, but is always a little bit concerned about the fact that he's going too far. And she is the one who really called a halt to the whole notion of his illness being just a comedy trope. Because it was used in so many comic moments or in so many dramatic moments that you were like, the Huell bumps into him and plants in the court scene in which a lot of the whole season hinges. Essentially, the Chuck narrative hinges on that one moment where he gets humiliated in the court because they've planted a battery on him, and it proves essentially that his disease is psychosomatic. It has been funny up to this point in some places. It's been played for laughs. But it was Kim who drew our attention to the fact that this is a mental illness and that HHM should have been treating him as somebody who had a mental illness as opposed to a cash cow when they were dealing with him the whole way through this. And the only other person who had dealt with it like a mental illness was Jimmy. And I think that the writers kind of slowly stopped making it funny and started making it more serious. And ultimately, at the end, his suicide is shocking, like really shocking. But it comes at the end of an episode where it makes sense. So
I don't know if that's a bit of an oxymoron where this shocking thing still makes sense. The arc continues. You can see when you're certainly looking back, you're like, oh, okay, I can see where that came from. But at the same time, pretty shocking.
Yeah, like even just the process of him tearing his house apart to find that little flicker of electricity, that for me is just your jaw has dropped at that point when you're watching it and you're like, oh my God, this is a tragedy. And then you actually I didn't really see the end coming at all. As soon as it cuts to Chuck at the very end, when there's only a couple of minutes left of the season, you know what's going to happen. Like, it's almost like, in terms of being up there with these spirals we've seen from characters and in television and film, I don't know why, but the first thing I thought of was Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, and the spiral that his character goes through near the end. Of course, very different circumstance and very, very different conclusion on that case. Like, he had a murderous streak, his character, and they are very different characters. But it was the last time I truly felt watching a character thinking, oh my God, this is absolutely horrific, the sort of dissolution of your well-being and what's going on inside your head. And like, I'm not sure that they ever played up for laughs. I think that there was always a couple of moments where it was actually up to the audience to decide how they would take something. Like, and I think the scene in season two when they're in the copier shop and he's kind of roaring at the guy behind the counter. The guy behind the counter is obviously a bit of a comedy vehicle, I think, for the audience. But he ends up smacking his head off the counter. And I wonder, is it at that moment when the audience is like, hold on a minute, this is a very, very serious plot point that could become more serious in the next series of the television show.
Yeah, it's kind of part of what I was talking about last week, about kind of the sibling rivalry taking place against this backdrop of kind of the bigger issues going on with Chuck. But I thought it was really interesting. I was reading a Michael McKean interview from the time just after the final episode had aired, and he was saying that basically you have to take a step back and realize that all these characters exist in this universe as part of the kind of telling the Jimmy Salt story. And just something you said, Jer, about the fact that he's the first person to kind of treat it seriously as like a mental illness, and he's the guy looking after him. That's kind of where we see his humanity and so on. But then also that kind of makes it crueler when he turns on his brother and, you know, humiliates him in the courtroom. Just so people don't remember, like, the whole going to the effort of busting in his ex-wife from 4,000 miles away. So it actually, we spoke about Jimmy being this guy who like kind of does bad things professionally, but he's not a bad guy. But I think they're just kind of casting shadows on that kind of cozy relationship we have with him, especially if you remember in the court scene, there's a bit where Kim's speaking to him during a little intermission, and she after his wife has showed up, she goes, you know, she's gonna hate him and she's gonna hate you now. And Jimmy just kind of shrugs his shoulders and he's like, like, you know, it's all collateral damage. But yeah, just, it's amazing as well, kind of like from the second half of the series, you've kind of gone through this sort of three-series arc with Chuck, where they know he's coming to an end, and really they can just like burn that character out and do it spectacularly, and there's no more kind of cloak and dagger and holding back. So yeah, just what you were talking last week, Jer, about season two possibly being one of the all-time great series, for me this is the high watermark of Better Call Saul, and just, yeah, brilliant, brilliant run, and all hinge on that Chuck character.
For sure. Like, I would probably be with you on that one, Joe, that it does take a step up from season two, I think, just throughout start to finish, because you start at the moment of the recording and you finish at the moment of Chuck dying. Like, that's shoehorns in between two hugely significant moments in the entire plot, whereas I felt season two had a bit of work to do to actually get up to speed before it explodes and before it really sucks us in to being unbelievably interesting. At what point do you start to feel sorry for Chuck in this season?
I mean, I'm not sure that, I don't know if I do until the very last second. Like, he is a complete asshole. He is a self-obsessed, preening, vicious, nasty character who has kept his brother down. So, I mean, I'm on Jimmy's side there's a little bit of inconsistency, I think, in terms of what Jimmy's capable of, and you see a little bit of it later on too. I'm not always sure about what his motivation is, but I think that's where Kim kind of comes into it. I wasn't on Chuck's side at any point in like, I was completely on Howard's side when Howard sat him down and said, look, it's time for you to just relax. You've got loads of money in the bank. You could go and have an amazing post
career as a lecturer, and come in and out of the office if you want. Keep, like, read your papers, have your library, do whatever you want. But, like, his ego wouldn't let him. And just that constant, the view back of what life was like when they were kids and what they went through, for there to be nothing from Chuck, no residual sense of understanding that the only person who treated him with kindness while he was mentally ill was his brother, who looked after him, who got the papers, who dropped in the food and the gas canisters. Like, that all counts for something. And so when he's getting his revenge in the courtroom, it is years and years and years and years of being treated like a dog that are like, so she's going to be pissed off at me. She's going to get lots of money from this anyway. Like, things worked out for her and she left him. You know, like, granted, she didn't know what his mental illness was, but there was no, she didn't stick around to find out either, you know? So, I don't know. I didn't have any sympathy for Chuck beyond the fact that obviously he's mentally ill and it's a horrific burden for him to carry. But I don't think the mental illness turned him into an asshole. He wasn't mentally ill when he was lying about the mother's last words, right? That was all new.
Not too sure about that. Like, I think they set him up as this asshole and this, like, you're kind of looking, you're going, why can't this guy? It's actually, I can't remember where it was somewhere in the series when I was looking back when Saul was really exasperated with him. He's just saying, Chuck, why can't you just be normal? And the whole thing is that he can't. I think they really hammered at home. Like, actually went back and checked. It's that sequence of him destroying the house and trying to stop the meter ticking where, like, we've seen he's tried to move on and tried to kind of pretend like, oh yeah, I'm getting treatment and it's all grand now. And look, the lights are back on. But still, the meter's running and he's losing his mind. Like, they spent 7 minutes of just him, like, with no dialogue, unraveling, which I think was really, they built him up as this asshole and this egomaniac. And why can't he just stop being an asshole? But then I think they tried to flip it and kind of make you feel that sympathy because it's like, okay, this guy's gone. And then that also raises questions. Like, could someone have helped him? Could there have been another resolution that's not him burning his house down and killing himself?
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Who's your favorite superhero?
The OTB Kids Takeover. We're giving the stuck at home.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.